All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us tonight on the Meeting of the Unknowing Minds podcast. It is incredible to have you here for episode number 27. Actually, before we get into it, I've got something exciting for you. We've been sitting down behind the scenes, popping our own couple tops, trying to figure out what in the world we have going on here. And we've decided to change the name. So from now on, we're going to be changing it here. It's going to be the Off Track Podcast at the Meeting of the Unknowing Minds Studio. Is absolutely what we're going to be going with. So the Off-Track Podcast, a lot of the stuff we believe that we talk about has to do with the track and field world, but also how to better us as coaches. And tonight, we have an incredible guest. Let me get to her in a second real quick. But as always on the panel, we've got Scott Williamson from the University of Nevada. We've got Darren Flowers out of the UTRGV sitting down there by Mexico. We've got John Bell in his bald head. He's sitting up there in St. Louis rubbing and hanging out with the Billiken. And Tom Sage joined us over from VCU. He's joining us as well from his brand new house. They just put together his bed. So we're excited to have him there. All right, on the podcast tonight, we have an incredible guest. We're actually going to go back. So go ahead, pop a top right now. Go ahead and pour whatever you want to do and pull a chair to the table. Because honestly, we're going to go back in time a little bit with our history professor, Victoria Jackson, the former North Carolina Tar Heel, the former Arizona State and national champion. Let's not forget that. She was a 10K national champion for Arizona State after transferring over. But she's a sport historian and clinical assistant professor of history in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. We've seen her on 60 Minutes, the LA Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe, the Slate, the Atlantic, the Independent. And it is going to be an incredible conversation, one that had all of us sitting back and rethinking the way that we actually think about collegiate sports. So sit back, relax, and as we said, pop the top, pour a little something on ice. Let's enjoy this one. What could you, you ran professionally afterwards. You saw these things with the track series, the pro track series coming up, right?
Yeah, I saw the announcement today.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of crazy.
And that it had been in the works for a while. And I mean, we've seen like variations or iterations of this in the past, but yeah. I don't know, like, competing in Europe is awesome. So like, why you would opt out of like going and hanging out in Belgium? Like,
just,
I understand like some people have like financial, like, you know, it's not like everybody can just pick up and go to Europe for the summer. I get that as far as like family or work or finances, but if you can, like, it's awesome.
What were the things that you know, we've had this conversation about, you know, what ways to make, track and field better in the U.S. And you just kind of alluded to, you know, how great some of these are in Europe. What are some of the things that you really liked about like competing in Europe?
Oh, just, well, I mean, it like clearly was part of the culture to like go hang out at a track meet. And like, you know, there's like in Belgium, all of the different brewers, like you like Belgian beer, you drink it in the glass that the maker has designed specially for that type of beer. And so at these meets, those glasses are there too. And like, you know, they take their beer drinking seriously and respect their, you know, beer brewers. So they're like, after the meet, there's all these glasses left in the stands. And then each like respective company goes around and collects the glasses. They play music. It's like clear, like, you know, there's like people cooking out and like beer garden. It's just part of the culture to go to a track meet. And then like I competed at a Grand Prix. This was pre Diamond League, so I'm aging myself, but I competed at a Grand Prix meet in Helsinki. And my PhD advisor at ASU at the time I was doing Native American history, there were two Finnish academics who had come to the States to study with him and were teaching at the University of Helsinki. And so my advisor wrote them like, hey, I have a student coming through, like didn't say why I was in town. And so they come to pick me up from the hotel, and you race late at night, so you're just like killing time during the day. And they're like, so what are you like, are you here on a research trip? I'm like, oh no, I'm racing in the meet tonight. They're like, oh my gosh, like it's sold out. You know, it's like a 60,000 seat stadium. Yeah. And it's like sold out. And they're like, they were like, we tried to get tickets. It's the biggest event in Helsinki of the year. And like, it, you know, it's televised. So they like came up with a hand signal that I could do so they could like prove to their wives that they were actually hanging out with an American who was competing in this track meet tonight.
That's like awesome.
You know, it's like, it's soccer and track in Europe. Yeah. And like, that's obviously not the case in the United States. So to experience a place that appreciates track and is like hang. It's like it when you're in Eugene and everybody's like knows how far a good triple jump is. Like that's everybody in Europe. So yeah, it's nice.
Yeah.
So we just have to get rid of professional football and professional basketball, and we'll be
and
okay.
Baseball
and we gotta serve some really good beer at the meets.
I think beer, the key music. Is having beer. Yeah. The beer. Beer and brats.
Hilariously enough, I was when I was talking to Dave a little while ago on the whole the ProTrack series as they're calling it. I was like, hey, what? How in the world did you come up with this? Like, maybe people have tried. You know, you've got 7 cities on here. It's for everybody. How can you try? And he's like, oh yeah, you know, the guy that you know myself, and then the guy that runs the Eddie Murphy Classic in Memphis, and the guy that runs the UA, you know, Under Armour Sunset Tour. We all got together and. It's like we were in a Meat Directors Anonymous AA meeting. Like, cause we just were so like, we were used to putting out meats and we can't do it. So we all literally were drinking and we came up with this meat series. It's like a lot of the Diamond League stuff. It was hilarious. I'm amazed. They've got an incredible schedule. LA, Portland, Des Moines, Nashville, back to LA for 2 and then finish up with Memphis. And he said they're going to look into one more meat. So put 8 meets on the schedule, starting May 14th, finishing up August 14th, but, you know, work the trials in and do that kind of stuff too. So they've got, they're looking for the prize pool. They're looking for a big name sponsor to finish that kind of stuff up to help it out. But they're going to go full bore with it and just say, hey, off we go and see if we can do something on it. And hopefully they can. I think it'd be great to get this stuff going. It really would. We need it. The sport needs it. But the American Track League is something else too. We've had Brian Fetzer on the show, and he said, I was talking to him earlier, and he's not allowed to tell me much, but he can tell me there's a 4 meet indoor series that is going to be, they're finalizing contracts right now as we speak with some of the TV networks to put them on and how those stuff is going to work. So I'm not allowed to say who it is. I'm not allowed to say where, I'm not allowed to say anything with that stuff, which I got to respect that because of course he's been on the podcast as well, but that'd be, if we can get something like this going, that'd be great. Amazing. Imagine what COVID's done. We got all of us sitting around drinking beer, talking, you know, apparently it's something for the good. Yeah. We got track meets that are going to be coming along. That's pretty cool. So Tom, how you doing, by the way?
I keep seeing some of these people posting their schedules and I'm just like, we're kind of afraid to do that yet. So
you posted ours.
You were one of them I saw.
Yep. It's okay.
Doing well, Matt. Doing well.
How you doing?
Yeah, doing well. Just sorry I'm a little late. Was finishing up dinner. Had to do some dishes, you know.
Yeah.
So.
New house. How's that new house? Finally, everything's settled.
I got my weight set put together. It took me way longer than it needed to. Should have been a 15-minute experience. It took me 2 hours. Had it upside down. I don't know how that happens, but.
That sounds like domestic life, man. Domestic life.
That and I put a bed together, bed frame. Don't have a bed for it yet for the guest bedroom, but I got a frame. So that's,
I'm sure the frame looks nice.
Frame looks nice, yeah. No no guests yet, so no rush.
Man, that's brilliant. Victoria, you've been everywhere. Every time I look on social, by the way, now I absolutely love following you on social. It's great. You've incredible insights. It's going to be fun here in a couple minutes. No questions about that. But every time you go, like you are honestly Miss Popular. You are everywhere. Every TV site you're going to go, you're on a website, you're on a podcast, you're doing an interview. Like, I know we talked about it earlier this week, but have you seriously slowed down at all?
Well, I'm fortunate in that ASU takes seriously the mission to do like community work and like to not be in an ivory tower, but to actually like share what we're doing. And so there's a big emphasis on public scholarship and much like, you know, the crisis in track and field or perceived crisis of the popularity of track and field, that's kind of similar humanities crisis in the humanities, which is just silly. Like you need history. History isn't going anywhere. But because of the perceived crisis, doing more to get our work out into the university has been encouraged. And so my role is to actually do more public scholarship than it is to teach a lot or to do like academic research so that I'm writing for academic journals that like 5 people read. Like, they'd rather me do a TV appearance or write an op-ed than like publish in like, you know, the Journal of American History or something like that. Not hating on the work that's for our academic audiences, that that stuff's really important too, but it doesn't mean we all should be doing it. We can be doing different things. So,
well, yeah, there's absolutely value in, you know, the publication of what you're doing, whether it's podcasts or TV. And I just wanted to thank you for doing that piece on 60 Minutes. That was amazing. I really appreciated the words that you were using. I think a lot of people could learn from those specific words. And I kind of wanted to ask, were those intentional? Some of the words that you were using, like business and, I mean, how did you get to that point, I guess?
Yeah, I'm very careful and intentional with the words that I use. And part of that is teaching, actually. I've been lecturing and teaching since 2012. So it's kind of nice because I can think of it on Olympic cycles. But, you know, like the harshest critics are 18 to 22 year olds. And when I do sport history, because I'm a woman doing sport history, it's not all students, but I do have those like very skeptical kind of gut reaction, like resistant responses to what I'm doing. And I think that has, you know, it actually, I've now learned that that means that student is actually beginning the process of thinking differently about the world. Because that like emotional or like physical experience of resistance is the first step toward like starting to rethink or reconsider the way you think about things. So that means I've been teaching for 8 years now. And you also have to get to the point when you're teaching. You can't like kind of fake your way through something or get lost in the weeds. Like, you have to hit the big ideas and use powerful language, but in a careful way. So teaching college was a nice kind of way to practice doing a lot of the media that I do now.
That's awesome.
Absolutely. I love that. That's, you've learned a lot. What, so curiously enough, with some of the way things have changed, what can we change of a track meet? I think we'll just start with the most broad question here. What can we change of a track meet? What would you do? Because you've been on the collegiate circuit and you've been on the pro circuit a little bit like that. What could a collegiate track meet change to? What would you like to see done?
Yeah, I think it depends on what the goals are. I think when you're an athlete, you're like, a lot of the messaging you receive is all that matters is performance, and times and improvement, and like, regardless of all the other stuff, or like, you know, just kind of pushing that other stuff to the side. And I mean, I've seen this with athletes in the way they've decided to opt out or opt in with social media and like promoting themselves as a brand. You have athletes who are like, my performances speak for themselves, and blah, blah, blah. Well, if the purpose of this is to increase engagement with the sport and attention on the sport and convince other people that this is like a cool, fun sport, then like, you do need to have a personality. You do need to think about the entertainment value and not just the performances. And if you think about like the way other sports are marketed, not just in the United States, but around the world, like, there has been a dramatic shift in the entertainment around sporting events that kind of enhances the events themselves. So, I mean, it depends what the goals are. Like, I mean, there's so much mixed messaging in college sports. Like, it's educational, it's for the students, it's all that revenue generation so that your team isn't cut. Like, or, you know, and so does that mean you need to be like, you know, it's messaging that pulls you in a lot of different directions. And so I think just having kind of intentionality about, okay, what are the goals here? If the goal here really is to increase intention on this sport, how do we come up with a plan to actually achieve that?
Isn't that the $1 million? That's the biggest thing. The promoting your brand, I think I might open up the biggest, one of the big cans right now, but promoting your brand and promoting yourself, you've written about it before. Is there a really good way, you think, to actually like pay college athletes, not pay college athletes? Is there a good way to go about it? Cause I know a lot of us, I'm in the boat right now. I've read pieces. I can be swayed to the left and to the right every day on which way to go about this. my gut is normally don't do it because I don't even know that there's a fair system. Like the track meet, we just don't know how it's going to get put on. But I'm not sure if there's a good way to go about paying them, even though I understand that, yeah, their name, the NIL, they need to be paid something. But how do you make that equal, fair value? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, first, name, image, and likeness isn't colleges paying athletes. It's restoring to students who play sports the economic rights of other students on campus. So I think people often give like the music analogy. And I played in the orchestra at UNC and had like, you know, different stand partners throughout the course of the 4 years. And what's many that, of them.
What instrument? I got to ask.
I play the violin.
Okay.
And I had stand partners who were music majors and, you know, sometimes they were on scholarship and they play gigs on the weekends and make money off of their amateur musical status and like still come back the next week with their scholarships and their eligibility to play intact. Like it's all of this is artificial. And I think all the fear mongering around like, oh, athletes aren't going to care anymore about school and, oh, they're just going to be invested in like maximizing or optimizing the potential of monetizing their NIL. It's all silly. Like we fetishize technology in higher education. If there's a student who develops a new app, not only is that like university going to be promoting it, that like that student's going to be encouraged to continue on this educational pathway. I think part of this is like a false divide, high art, low art, this idea that sport isn't educational inherently of itself, or that it's like an art that requires like incredible talent. It's just all artificial. And so I think, I mean, I'm convinced that there's going to be a delay, drag it out. We're still not going to see NIL for many more years.
I agree. Yeah. And,
like there's no way it's starting this summer. I will be shocked if like this starts in the summer. But yeah, that's a separate conversation from paying athletes. I think I don't see schools ever being in a situation where they're treating athletes as employees and paying them and having, you know, labor rights and collective bargaining agreements. I think schools would spin off football first. Basketball kind of solves itself because there's alternative pathways to the NBA. So you have the G League and the compensation packages in the G League have been dramatically enhanced. And there's also like college opportunities in the G League now. And then the Professional Collegiate League is launching in the summer. And that's, you know, the people who've been trying to disrupt the NCAA are now launching this league. You know, if they can't do it internally within the system, they're just going to develop something, you know, different and disrupt from the outside. And so the Professional Collegiate League pays high school, you know, they're going after the same star recruits coming out of high school. They're offering compensation and college scholarships. So the football and, you know, the football business is what schools have been in historically. If you look at the history of NCAA policy, it's football. Like it's a history of NCAA football policy because that's where the schools make their money. And I should say, like, my work is on the Power Five or the schools, you know, before that it was the CFA, these schools that are the top 65. It's this football money and the football business that the schools care about the most. So. I don't see that happening. I mean, they would have to get an exemption from Title IX too to treat football differently. I don't actually, at this point, football is so categorically different from other sports. You know, I was opposed to them when, because schools tried to do this in the 70s. They first tried to get all sports exempted from Title IX, and then there was an attempt to have football and men's basketball excluded from compliance. That actually shouldn't have happened in the 70s because the money was so different. But since the 70s, you know, this business has just so dramatically accelerated. I mean, just in the last 20 years, it went from $4 billion a year to $14 billion a year. And that's all explained by football. So I don't think they could get an exemption anyway. So this spinning off is the best thing schools could do. And I don't think institutions of higher education should be in the business of football anymore, knowing what we know about the sport and that it's inherently harmful to brains. Like hitting is what causes CTE. Blocking is what causes CTE. It's not concussions, it's the subconcussive hits. So I think it's a good opportunity for higher education to get out of the football business.
Do you think that, sorry, do you think some of the bigger schools might consider breaking away from the NCAA to continue the football business?
I mean, if I were in charge, if I got to tell people what to do, I would want the Power Five to spin off football and the rest of the schools to drop it. There's no reason to have all these football teams. And then you have an age group league. You make the NFL do something to support it. I mean, they're getting off easy. Like the higher ed is doing the NFL's bidding. 100% of NFL draft picks come from the NCAA. There is no other pathway to the NFL. And 75% of NFL draft picks come from the Power Five. And the NFL is 74% Black too. So if we're thinking about like the talent here, it's Black players in the Power Five conferences. So yeah, there's no reason for mid-majors to have football at this point. And I think it would actually do a lot of good for kind of returning to a scholastic model of sport and the rest of intercollegiate athletics, especially outside of those top 65 schools. Like I think it would do a lot of good. just kind of a recentering.
We've actually said, I think we've been saying that for a long time now on this, at least on this podcast, that football and basketball have, you know, men's basketball have, they're professional organizations at this point. They're not, they don't look anything like an amateur organization in any way, shape or form. And so, you know, I've said it that I would almost like to see the university presidents start to take back their athletics department. You know, you've got these departments that are run separately from, you know, from the institution, almost as their own LLC. And these university leaders need to start to take back the Olympic sports and take back some of these football and basketball. And I told this to Darren last week, those horses have left the barn and we're not getting them back. They're too big. There's too much money. And so we need to somehow manage everything else and let them kind of go off and do their own thing. I don't know how we can continue. We cannot, I mean, I don't think we can continue down the path that we're going with, you know, they're the elephant in the room, football and basketball. We can't deal with them.
Yeah, they support many industries too. Football in particular, it's, first of all, it's like the farm league for the NFL. Yeah. It's subsidizing intercollegiate athletics and kind of, you know, again, since I studied the Power Five, that's just incredible. I mean, some people kind of condescendingly call it bloating, but the dramatic expansion of athletic department, like administrators, staff, football staff, just all these new positions in the last 20 years. Olympic development. I mean, we're essentially seeing the labor of disproportionately Black athletes subsidizing Olympic development in the United States. And it's not just the US, like the world's athletes come to train in American colleges because the facilities are the best in the world. Like it's a step down to participate in college sports and then turn pro in virtually any sport because of all of the spending on, I mean, like the all these exceptional people, like the trainers and athletic performance and the coaches and the facility, I mean, all the bells and whistles, like it's incredible. Like the Pac-12 when it finished, if the Pac-12 were a country, the Pac-12 would have placed fifth at the Rio Olympics. There were 246 athletes representing 47 countries from the Pac-12 in Rio. And they earned 55 medals, one behind Russia. So like, yeah, I mean.
And that was paid for by football, basically.
Yeah.
The training experience of all those kids, all those athletes, was inherently football and basketball money.
Yeah, the big time experience of a Power Five conference is subsidized by football. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So local economies. I mean, we heard like Mike Gundy, the Oklahoma coach, talking about money like flowing through the state of Oklahoma. That's why they had to play this fall. I mean, there are so many counties. And then the big one that there was a piece by Ian Boggest in The Atlantic, and that just made everything click for me. I recommend you check it out. It's not about sports. It's about colleges. And he wanted to answer this question, like, why were we so dead set on returning to American college campuses this fall? Like, why was there such effort put into this by the universities, but also parents, like this need to send their kids off during a pandemic to have a college experience on campus? And his main thesis is that higher education in the United States is not in the business of selling education. It's in the business of selling the collegiate experience, what it means to go to college. Yeah. And I think, like, yeah, I had an awesome time in Chapel Hill. I know exactly what that means. But like, football is a core feature of the collegiate experience. And mm-hmm. football, I think more than anything, is what signals to Americans and to prospective students and their families, this is what it means to go to college. And that we have people who feel entitled to a collegiate experience. It's why we saw Notre Dame students rushing the field after they beat Clemson in double overtime during a pandemic and like making vulnerable the athletes they were celebrating, because those football players did not have protective masks on, because they felt entitled to that experience of rushing the field. And so football, that's what I mean when I say that football has a different relationship to the university than other sports do, because football is part of this project of selling the collegiate experience to Americans and what it means to go to college. And I think that reading that, it was the most important thing about college sports that wasn't even about sports that I read in 2020 for me to make sense of what's going on in this space.
It's amazing. what is it? Because we cut football 6 years ago. And I've talked about this before. We cut football and then we brought football back.
And that's right.
Yes, we did. And the amazing thing was, I remember actually on my interview, I asked my SWA, I said, she's like, well, do you have any questions? I'm like, yes. Am I going to have a job in 5 years? And she said, why do you have a job in 5 years? I was like, well, are you guys going to cut track? And she's like, we would never cut track. I'm like, yes, but you cut the uncuttable, which is football. And she paused for a second, was like, wait a minute, hold up. But our enrollment, I've gone into the financial numbers before on what we've gained since we've come back. I mean, in 6-7 years, we're north of $70-80 million now for just that. All of our facilities are brand new, or at least quickly going. Some of my office is built in like 1901, so they can't tear it down. But our enrollment numbers went from, we were at 21,000 before everything happened. So this is 2015, to almost just south of 17,000. And then with everything coming back right now, I think this year with our incoming class, we'll be at about 23,000.
Oh, wow.
4,000 to 5,000 kids, not to mention the admission, not to mention, you know, every single little fee that you're going to get along with those kind of stuff, application fees and everything else. We lost all of that because football got dropped here for 18 months. I mean, it crushed everything. It didn't matter what it is. And in the South, there's no way in hell that you could ever see a school without football. You go up north, you know, the school like a Bradley of the world, or maybe a non-scholarship like a Butler, yeah, they're going to be fine. They're going to survive. St. Louis as well.
At St. Louis, we don't have football. We have the real football.
Yeah. You in Dayton, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to not rub that in. You know, but it's amazing. You're 100% right. I would have never thought of the piece, but you're right. That is one of the most important things, is bring football back and bring the money back. We've talked about it before. You can bring football back. You'll bring the money back into the schools, and then it does help us out a little bit.
A little bit, but I, you know, you're talking about facilities and stuff, and that's great, but it kind of is like, you know, a mid-major. Mm-hmm. It's like you bring in the football money that you bring in, but it's like, how much is going out the door? Like, it just kind of seems like, I mean, you talk about the Power Five, and I get it. They're bringing in so much money, but I feel like, a school like St. Louis, it's like, you know, they're able to, you know, do what they do and still have really nice facilities and, you know, make ends meet. But, you know, some of these other schools, you know, I mean, we were both in the Southland at Nichols and stuff. And it's like, you know, you had a football program and stuff, but it's like, what kind of drain was hopefully they're not listening, but I mean, the drain that they had on the whole athletic department, because it was like, hey, we got to have a football team out there. And it's like, yeah, we bring in, you know, a couple million dollars, but we spend $4 or $5 million.
I think you've got two issues here though, because, you know, at a place like Nichols or some of these mid-major schools that have football, that try to rely on football money that they just can't generate. You know, I think that's a problem. Whereas a place like St. Louis University, we are, I mean, yes, we have season ticket sales for men's basketball. We have the, you know, the credit, you know, the NCAA tournament credit from making the NCAA tournament. But yep. Outside of that, we are more or less one. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I guess at least 90%, 92% subsidized by the university. And so our institution realizes that, hey, we're not, this is, it's still a co-curricular activity for our students that participate in track and field and field hockey and swimming and diving and basketball and soccer, whatever. You know, it's not, clearly the university president would like us to sell as many season tickets as possible and have, you know, make the NCAA tournament. Those are big deals. But at the end of the day, I mean, there was a time period, you know, I've been at SLU for 14 years. There was a decade there, you know, where we didn't make the NCAA tournament. So we had no credits coming in, yet we still spent a lot of money. And that was all subsidized by the university. And, you know, of course, yes, we got some donations and we have a strong Billiken club. But, you know, Gary Wilson said this weeks and weeks and weeks ago on our podcast that it's a priority problem, right? Division One has a priority problem of what exactly are we trying to do with our athletics department? Are we actually trying to educate and mold and shape young men and women, or are we just trying to make money? And again, that's where I get into this tangent of, well, football and basketball have kind of left they've left the barn and you're not going to get them back. And they are 100%, I think, at this point in time, all about the money. I think anybody who would argue against that I think that's crazy, but you know, that's why I say the university presidents need to take it back and start to subsidize some of these Olympic sports and not put the burden on football to do that.
Oh, go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I was, you know, I agree 100%. And I just watch year in and year out and you see these, what is it? The group of six, you know, this year it's Cincinnati and it's Boise State and stuff. And it's these schools that are chasing that payday of like, we're going to make it into the New Year's Six games and stuff. And it's like, they've never made it. And it's like, they're probably, I mean, I don't want to ever say they're probably never going to make it. They're, you know, Boise's in our conference, but it's like, I mean, all these years they're just kind of chasing that money.
How about today? Coastal Carolina just extended their head football coach 7 years.
You know, I know. That one in a million shot. It's like, we're going to just keep dumping money into, you know,
they
that.
They were going to lose him. They had to spend to keep him.
I understand that component of it. But again, it's here they've made this huge financial investment into a program that before this year, I had never heard of Coastal Carolina football. I knew of Coastal Carolina, the university, but never heard of Coastal Carolina football. And what are the odds now moving forward that they, again, you look at a year where the Big Ten is hardly playing games because of COVID. You have the Pac-12 struggling with COVID. I mean, the ACC and the SEC have either they have different protocols or you know, whatever they're doing.
Everybody already had it, so they're good.
Yeah, they've already had it. So they've pushed through.
LSU, I'm quoting LSU. I'm not saying that. LSU.
So you have this institution, Coastal Carolina, that has clearly had a great year, but of all years to have a great, I mean, can they do this next year or in 2 years or 3 years when kind of the world hopefully gets back to normal and all is right in the intercollegiate universe? I mean, are they going to be a powerhouse? I hate to be the Debbie Downer, but probably not.
And how much money are they going to spend?
And they've made this huge financial investment into a program that, man, it's going to hurt other kids in their department long-term.
Oh, I agree. Cause I feel like they're going to feel like we almost made it. It's almost that little carrot. It's like, we almost made it. So we're going to dump more money into it, you know, trying to get there.
Yeah. And I think your point about this all, like not having any course, that it's kind of spending for spending's sake or believing that winning is good in and of itself because it is very much kind of baked into a lot of athletic department decision-making. And this idea that schools are in the business of making money, it's actually slightly different than that, I would say. And this is where I think administrators and university presidents agree with me. because the Chancellor of Wisconsin got a lot of flack when she said, when she was testifying in one of these Senate hearings over the summer around name, image, and likeness, that schools are not in the business of making money. She got a lot of pushback and it was like, no, that's true. Schools are in the business of intercollegiate athletics is in the business of excellence, and that's winning, right? And that means spending money, because you have to spend money in order to win and be excellent, because you have to keep pace with the others who are spending money because you're competing for recruits. And so it's an arms race because, you know, in order to get the best talent, you have to attract them in ways other than offering them compensation because of amateurism. So, but then there's no intentionality around it. It's just kind of taking as fact that winning in college sports is the be all end all. But when that project is in institutions of higher education, it's inherently going to cause problems. And when it's all predicated on this idea that it's in service of the students, but in fact, it's driven by these other forces and businesses, it's just inherently going to be problematic. And the, you know, the pandemic exposed that this model is rotten and always has been. Every single time there's an economic downturn, we see teams getting cut. And so that proves that the priority is not the educational experiences of the students. In fact, it's this core business, which is football, and this concept of competing with other schools to get the best recruits to win. That's not an intentional model. And it's certainly causing more harm, I think, to students. And especially when students playing those sports like football are not graduating or having the educational experiences and opportunities that they're being promised. If the trade-off here is this world-class education, but then the actual educational experiences of students who play sports is something different from what typical students get on that campus, then the trade-off it's not there at all.
One of the things I think the pandemic has shown us, though, is that technology is playing a bigger and bigger role in the college experience. I guess my question would be, where do you see technology being a disruptor in the future for athletics in general?
You know, this has been a debate that's been taking place. My school has had long before the pandemic committed to robust, vigorous, high quality online education, both for our so-called traditional students who are enrolled and attending in person. And then also, I mean, we also have ASU Online, which is for students anywhere in the world. And knowing our president, Michael Crow, anywhere in the universe, because he wants to educate everyone and give them opportunities to get an ASU education. It takes a lot of work to create the same sort of educational experiences online as it does in person. But at the same time, for our students who are craving in-person engagement and what it means to go to college, we are working really hard to come up with ways to create those opportunities in safe ways at ASU. And I imagine across universities, around the world, because we're having issues with retention, like everyone is around the world. And there's a belief that that's tied to these in-person engagements and experiences. And of course, because I just learned from Ian Bogost in The Atlantic that higher education is in the business of selling the collegiate experience, of course. for our student athletes, I think, you know, the universities like ours that offer a lot of online courses for in-person students, they're incentivized to take those courses because it's far easier to balance athletic and academic roles and responsibilities when you can take a class at any time instead of attending synchronously in person. We have a hockey team at ASU that, you know, there are no, because a donor wanted a hockey team. And so they were like, well, Title IX. So we also added women's lacrosse, and this donor subsidized that too. We got two sports out of it. But again, for me, I'm like, what? Is there any intentionality around this? Because there are no teams. It's hard to have a hockey arena in the desert. It's non-sustainable. The ice is crap. They joined the Big Ten for the pandemic. ASU is an honorary member of the Big Ten for this pandemic season of hockey. But in normal times, they'll be on the East Coast for 2 weeks. because that's where they go to play. And so, of course, our hockey students, when they're playing, are enrolled in online courses. And that's okay. Like, that's not a bad thing. But we, like, all should be slowing down timelines or giving our, you know, students who play sports additional educational opportunities on the back end of their athletic careers. Like, if they want to get another degree and attend in person and like do study abroad or have an internship, like, they should be able to do that too. And the school absolutely should come up with ways to subsidize that instead of, say, having buyout contracts or buyout clauses in football coaches' contracts. I mean, that's one way you could pay for like all of American college students to have another year of school. Like, we're at $50 million so far in buyouts going to football coaches just this season alone. So, yeah.
Lovie Smith was the most recent one, right, at Illinois. And I guess I have a follow-up question to that. You know, TV contracts kind of lead the way, and you see these TV deals. And I forget, ESPN, was it with the SEC, just renegotiated a contract through, I believe, 2025 or something like that. You see this kind of Netflix model of streaming disrupting other things as well. Do you feel that maybe there's more fragmentization coming with the potential of streaming and maybe in niche sports like track and field or swimming and diving or gymnastics, et cetera?
Yeah, I think the way to look to see how to innovate in selling a sports league and coming up with alternative ways of streaming or, you know, going on Twitch or just anything to get your sport and more eyes on your sport to recognize the excellence of your sport is to go to women's professional leagues and to see the type of innovative work they've been doing. That's the growth space right now, despite the pandemic. Viewership has been increasing. You know, when all the other leagues have been going down, women's sports have been accelerating and they're getting more branding opportunities. And there's new franchises like Angel City Football Club and new brand partners. And so because women hustle, like especially women's professional team sports, that they just know they have to hustle because everybody is going to be against them or working against their advancement. Whether it's sports media not covering them or the hate that they get everywhere. So I think one thing I'm sure will happen if universities no longer are in the football business is that they will no longer be inhibiting the growth and development and expansion of excitement around non-revenue sports. I think the Pac-12, the Big Ten, and women's athletics and those places really, really reveal the underdevelopment of the potential to blow those out. If you look at UCLA gymnastics or Stanford volleyball or Minnesota volleyball or ASU softball, like there is such excitement around these teams. And it's not just the Power Five. It's like, you know, those college towns everywhere. There is so much excitement around college sports and like sports like softball or track and field or beach volleyball. If your school has a beach volleyball team, like people want to come out and see that. And I think the overemphasis on football and the obsession with football money and football donors and football, you know, branding has actually inhibited the growth in those other sports. And that I think we'll see, and especially if like a fully embraced NIL is adopted, we're going to see a lot of really cool stuff happening in the non-revenue sports space in colleges. I shouldn't call them non-revenue, but there's no other way to like signal what you're talking about.
Non-ticketed.
Okay.
We had a business manager when I gave him like $12,000 of meet entry fees. He said, "Oh, you guys have revenue now, so we can't call you non-revenue. You're just non-ticketed."
No, we sell tickets. We actually sell a good amount of tickets. It's kind of fun. They're lucky with the cross pucks and the amount of stuff that we have. I'm always worried with all this going on. Like, And do you worry that we're going to see a lot more sports get cut here in the next, let's say, 18 months? A lot more teams? Because I don't know how many, because I think you made a very great point. I think some track teams are going to go. I know you, sorry, you did not say that. I'm saying that. But you made the point of that. now I forgot completely where I was going with this. with COVID coming on, it just blew the cover off of what's wrong with college sports right now. And it shows the fact, I think if you, anybody watched the CFP a couple nights ago, with the fact of those power schools haven't changed, teams haven't played. The Big Ten is not, you know, it's pretty much canceled their season just to make sure Ohio State stays in. Teams like that are making sure, the SEC is doing the exact same thing. It's showing how much money goes. And it scares me. It really does. Then the next 18 months, we're going to see not one or two, but we're going to see a ton more teams, teams on college campuses get cut. Even though the William & Marys and Minnesotas and Clemsons are fighting back, those kids are fighting back tooth and nail. It's beautiful to see. I don't know how many people are actually going to survive. I don't think administrators are going to sound and say, you know what? I don't want the bad press that Clemson and Minnesota got. I don't want that. But we still need to do this because we have to pay Gus Malzahn $21 million for his buyout.
I think it is cyclical. So there were over 200 teams cut coming off the Great Recession. And, you know, the continued economic fallout from the pandemic, like we're I don't even think we're midway through, the recession that we're in now. Fighting to get those sports back, of course, like if your sport isn't cut, yeah, you're going to do that. But it doesn't correct the continuing problem, which is that every single time in this current model, there's an economic downturn, teams get cut. And the Big Ten has grown too big. I graduated from UNC in 2004, and then I competed as a grad student for two more years. And that, I mean, in those 6 years alone, you could sense a shift happening in intercollegiate athletics. Like when I competed at UNC, you know, this university of the people, by the people, for North Carolinians, that has a very, very restrictive cap on the number of out-of-state students that can go to Carolina. It has to be 82% in-state. Like they take it seriously that the flagship school is for the people of North Carolina. Our uniforms are state property. Like you checked it out in the equipment room, like you were in high school, and returned it at the end of the season. And if you were graduating and you hadn't returned your uniform, your graduation would be held up. Like you would not be allowed to graduate. So, just a couple years later, we're like jet setting, flying everywhere. We go to race. We're getting these huge packages from Nike. I'm sure that's the case at Carolina now. I'm sure they're no longer checking out their uniforms from an equipment room. That was the beginning point of this acceleration in the money, this $4 billion a year to $14 billion a year acceleration. And then the sense of entitlement, and I don't mean that in a way to put people down, but when I saw like a bunch of post-collegiate professional athletes, you know, like posting on Instagram about like how tragic it is that Olympic dreams are being killed with these teams being cut. And like, time out. Like the bigger issue here is that football players are being forced to play during a pandemic. Like that is the big problem right now. That a Florida basketball player, we don't know if it was COVID related or not, like is in critical condition after collapsing on the court because he was playing because like these games must go on. That's the bigger problem here right now. And, you know, like I remember competing at one of the Stanford meets, you know, those like super late night meets where everybody runs a PR and everybody gets their Olympic trial standards. And when you're like reading through the results, it's like national record, national record, national record, America, like it's crazy, right? Those meets are really late at night. And I remember like, you know, you have like the fourth heat, the fifth heat kicking off at like midnight. There's teams from the East Coast who've flown out to run at Stanford. So they're racing at like 3 o'clock in the morning because they might run 3 seconds faster at Stanford than they would at Penn relays. Like we have lost our way. And like, who, like, what is paying for that cross country flight so that you can run 3 seconds faster? Like, I don't know. It struck me as very strange. I do think we're going to, what we should be doing is returning to a scholastic model of sport, regional competition. This, like, I mean, the conference realignment, which was the TV market expansion in 2011, that killed the Big East and all of that. Like, that is one thing. But these, like, out of conference, like, UNC and Michigan State playing on an aircraft carrier in San Diego Harbor, like, those sorts of spectacles. But in all of the sports, I mean, we've really lost our way. And I'm a historian. And if you look at the history of college sports, there have been lots of college sports outside of the NCAA. The history of the NCAA is not the history of college sports. And if you're looking at women's intercollegiate athletics and the Association for Intercollegiate Athletics for Women, which was the membership association for women's sports from 71 to 82, like, that was very focused on regional competition and then, you know, at the end of a season, national competition, focused on the educational experiences of students. It's like high school sport writ large. And like, if we're taking this seriously, that it is in the service of students, it needs to get more in line with that. Now, if there are programs, you know, if we see the top 65 schools breaking away in football and spinning off and selling, like, there is an opportunity for Olympic subsidization, Olympic development subsidization of those sports. If we want American colleges to be the Olympic development pathway for American athletes, like, there's other ways to subsidize that and to have kind of world-class developmental pathways in place. And, you know, that doesn't have to be subsidized by the university. That can come from private sources too.
So do you think it will take them breaking away for that to actually happen? Or is there a way under the current structure that we can start looking at more of a scholastic model? And how does that happen, in your opinion?
Yeah, historically, it's been outsiders intervening and saying you are not in charge anymore. So in the 70s, there was a presidential commission established. I want to say it was first established by Gerald Ford, and then Jimmy Carter inherited it. And this was the presidential commission leading up to the passage of the Amateur Sports Act in 1978, which stripped power from the AAU. The AAU basically ran Olympic development and the Olympic movement in the United States. And it's what's created the US Olympic Committee. And I think that's what's needed right now as far as rethinking college sports, rethinking Olympic development, rethinking youth sports. A lot of that, like that youth sports industrial complex is I think a little bit of a separate category and conversation from Olympic development and college sports. But yeah, I don't think industry insiders are the people best equipped to rethink the model and come up with something new. I think you need outsiders kind of given power from a president to come up with best models to study this and research it and then pass it off to Congress to get to work passing legislation.
Can I nominate
you? You know, Congress functions so well.
Yeah. Can I nominate you to move this forward?
I in my dream world, I would be in charge. Yeah, it would be fantastic. And then everybody would hate me and I wouldn't mind. So
I think with something with that kind of big skin or something, that's that kind of a job, you have to be able to have that kind of thick skin or because everybody will hate you. The way things are with it. I guess it was going to be one of my questions. Like, if we break off, you're right. I mean, I remember actually going for a run at my first convention with Mike Nelson and Marquette and Monmouth now is part of the podcast and somebody else who was gentleman Jeff Kent, who was at Arkansas and Purdue for a long time. We had that conversation where, when are sports going to break? When is the Power Five going to break off? This is 2009, 2010, my first couple conventions. I'm like, when are we going to break off? And we've never seen it go, but you're right. We saw it. I think I would, and then especially I was an athlete, graduated year after you did. And I felt the same exact thing when I was at Iowa, that there was a shift going on, that something was about to change. And I knew it just didn't make sense when the Big Ten picked up Maryland and Rutgers. And Scott, you're an Iowa guy as well. You know, we ran together. There's no way in hell that Maryland and Rutgers are Big Ten members. Sorry, guys. Penn State's very much a stretch as it is in my mind too, with that kind of stuff. Sorry, I'm throwing some shade on the Big Ten here just for the fun of it, you know, just because I can do that. So I guess that would say, question would be, are the Olympic sports, you mentioned it a little bit and you kind of laughed at it, but are Olympic sports in trouble?
Well, no, because of this college system we have in the United States. I mean, we are the only country in the world that has elite sport development in schools. And mm-hmm. at least right now, we're the only country in the world that has a multi-billion dollar sports industry in schools. And we're the only country in the world that has clung to amateurism when the world abandoned it with the Olympic movement. And yes. we're the only country with these things and also a gender equity and education law, Title IX. So if you want to understand why the US is dominant in the Olympics, it's not just because we're Americans and we're exceptional. It's because of these quirks of history. None of it has been intentional. We're almost excellent by accident, because, you know, when Title IX passed, it obviously is not a sports law, it's an education law. And like, I mean, people were making jokes on the floor of Congress about like, oh, are there gonna be women in the locker room now? Like they never considered the fact that this would be applicable in athletics too. And so I don't think any of that's going away. Like this, you know, elite sports in schools or like high quality competition sports in schools isn't going anywhere. And that means we have an infrastructure that other countries simply don't have. I mean, there's academy systems elsewhere, but you know, that's small. That's at such a smaller scale than all of the American universities that we have. So I don't think we're gonna see any sort of dramatic shift. The other quirk to this is American football, right? Like the world sport is soccer and our soccer evolved into American football on college campuses. And so we're the only place in the world where soccer is gendered female. It's why there's such resistance to women playing soccer elsewhere. It would be as if women were trying to play American football here. And that's why the US women's national team in soccer has been so dominant, because it's a female sport here because of Title IX in colleges. It's not to say that men don't play soccer in the US, but the infrastructure for women's soccer is because of colleges. Again, excellent by accident, or at least unintentional. But that, you know, that last Women's World Cup in France in 2019, the competitive balance, to use a word the NCAA loves to use, of that tournament was the best it's ever been, because European football clubs, soccer clubs, realized all they have to do is take like 1% of revenue and invest it in their women's sides, and they're going to be like global powers because there's so little investment in women's soccer. So the Spanish league, the French league, the Women's Super League in England, even in Italy, all the Netherlands, oh my goodness, you know, who played the women in the US women in the final, like their game is catching up and, you know, soon to be potentially leapfrogging the Americans because of the investment in women's soccer for the first time in those European leagues. And, you know, places like Manchester City Football Club, that it's like they read the Title IX regulations and implemented the qualitative experience of equal opportunity. Like the women have access to everything the men have in their training mm-hmm. grounds. Their social media and publicity is very much intentional to promote the women on par with the men. Mm-hmm. They don't use gender terms. The women take over the main social media feed when they play, that sort of thing. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying like American Olympic dominance isn't going anywhere because of all these exceptional quirks and historical forces in history.
You know, I think we'd be doing a disservice if we didn't talk about the racial opportunities that come about in our sport, specifically track and field. And, you know, I just saw something earlier today. A senator from South Carolina actually retweeted one of the Save Clemson Track and Field videos, and it was from the South Carolina team that put together a video. And, you know, I'm reading through the statistics here, and they say that 21 black athletes at Clemson were cut, but that's 67% of their non-revenue black athletes. So I guess the question I would have is, you know, how do you see equity when you when programs like this are being cut? How can you, as a pro or a university president or an athletic director, save face and say, you know, this is maybe something that we need to take a look at? And I'm glad that the senator from South Carolina is you know, vocal about this and going to be looking into this. And I, you know, just kind of touching on a couple of the subjects that we just talked about.
Well, I think Clemson is probably in violation of Title II. I think it's Title II of the Civil Rights Act. It's either Title II or Title VII. And if I had known we were going to be talking about this, I would have prepped and checked. Because there is not equal educational opportunity to attend. You know, if South Carolina is the flagship and Clemson is like alongside the flagship in the hierarchy of higher education in the state of South Carolina, they're not serving the people of the state. The student body makeup should be reflective of the demographics of the state. So I don't know what it is for South Carolina specifically. I know Louisiana. Louisiana black men make up just over 16% of the state population, but they make up about 4.5% of the student body and represent 77% of the football and men's basketball rosters. And you can look up all of the Power Five schools to get these stats from Sean Harper, Dr. Sean Harper, who directs the Race and Equity Center at the University of Southern California. So, I know South Carolina is similar. And Clemson is similar to LSU's stats. So I see it as a top-down and a bottom-up issue. The bottom-up issue is that American college sports are a technicolor illustration of the failure of residential and educational desegregation in the United States. Your zip code should not dictate the quality of the educational opportunities and experiences you have growing up as a young person in the United States, and it does. I grew up in the wealthy northern suburbs of Chicago, and attended a high school that had all of the sports. And lots of students from my high school went on to play college sports on scholarship in sports like water polo and field hockey and lacrosse. And, that means that if we're thinking about this in the other way, that college sports are a privilege for people like me, like getting to have a college scholarship based on my ability to play a sport is a privilege. And I benefited greatly. I'm a beneficiary of collegiate amateurism. But you also shouldn't have to play a sport to gain access to the state's top public institutions. And so I might be saying something that's different from the messaging coming out of Clemson. Sports are not a way to diversify a campus. And if you're a Black student who wants to attend Clemson, you shouldn't have to give something in return to be able to gain access to that place. And that's a problem. Now, you also shouldn't be cutting a sport like track and field because of its diverse representation on its roster, the fact that it isn't a privileged sport, the fact that, you know, a lot of people who go to play other sports at Clemson might be able to find other ways to subsidize their attending that university. But again, if it's football that's subsidizing all these sports, this idea that another sport should have been cut instead of track and field, for me, you know, you're not fixing the problem, which is like football athletes deserve better. And we need to rethink how we're doing the rest of intercollegiate athletics, because that disproportionately Black labor that's funding the other sports, like, it doesn't make it better that it's going to athletes that are diverse instead of majority white sports like baseball, for example. So the problem is still there. That said, I understand Clemson track that it's so tragic that their team has been cut. So I say all that, but also want to acknowledge like the effort and the campaign to restore Clemson track has been really admirable. But I think we also have to say that other stuff too.
So I'm hearing a lot of from what I'm hearing from you, it seems like we're looking at even sometimes a bigger issue, in that sometimes athletics is a microcosm of what universities and even maybe state legislators are pushing forward. That's kind of what I'm getting, but would that be true?
Yeah, I think bringing up state legislators is a great additional layer to this. And it's not just state representatives like serving in state houses, it's US Congress people. All these NIL hearings, it was so odd to me that you have all these Congress people from their respective states giving their opening statements or having their time to ask questions and feeling obligated to like talk about their personal fandom or their constituents' fandoms. Like, you don't think of this as being something for athletes. You see athletes as entertainers and people who are there to serve you. And that was really striking. But the other part of this is that I think sports by university presidents coverage. I think sports by professors like me that are saying things that the people of the state of Arizona might consider to be radical. Sports by me coverage, because sports are non-political. Sports are something we can all rally around. And so if you have these like I'm not radical, but perceived to be by conservative, you know, citizens of the state of Arizona, sports bias a lot of cover, so that we can do the work that we do in university spaces, because it's something everybody can rally around. So if you look at Wisconsin and the attack on higher education that's been taking place in Wisconsin from the governor or the state legislator, sports is doing a lot of work to protect and preserve things that might be completely gutted. So I think that's something that academics don't think about, and people in intercollegiate athletics don't think about too, that there's a lot of politicking going around. But ultimately, it's again, you know, the lives of the people who are playing these sports are kind of the last thing being considered. And I do think that's a reflection, if we're thinking of the long history of entertainers in the United States, and Black entertainers in the United States, like, you know, and there have been so many Black athletes recently or in the last decade who've spoken eloquently about this. Eric Stryker at Oklahoma State, when there was a fraternity that was chanting racist things, you know, he posted a video talking about like, when we're on the field and you're cheering for us, you love us, but we can't go to your frat parties, you know. Or Nigel Hayes, the Wisconsin basketball player, the way he's spoken so eloquently about the kind of subtleties of everyday racism he experiences as a Black athlete on a campus like Madison. It is very much, sports are often the front lines, because sports are about bodies. So these things that are part of the United States and US society that we might not experience explicitly are often experienced explicitly in sport. So the Darren using the term microcosm, I think really gets to the core of that.
It's an interesting way to do it. And again, I didn't see the conversation coming this way either. So I'm going to go with it. Tom, thank you for bringing that up, because it's something that we haven't brought up and we need to talk more about. And especially if anybody needs to go back and listen to Ken Cox talk a little bit about, Kenneth Cox. Kenneth, I completely apologize, talk about racial injustices and things that he's taken and he's seen as a Black male in the coaching world. It was actually a phenomenal conversation that we were blessed enough to have with him. Bring it back a little bit to track and field, if you can. Why not bring it back to something fun? And is there something that we as track coaches, you think we might be missing out on with everything going on that way? Is there a way to, we've asked this question to a few people from some of the administrators we've had on, from this, from our CEO of the Coaches Association, Sam Seams, and some other people. Is there something track coaches are missing? Because we've heard some people say, endow scholarships, that'll save your sport. I've heard other people say, hey, go talk to your legislator, that'll save your sport. And we have other people that said, like, dude, you're screwed no matter what. We've had the whole list of it. We can go down the whole thing. Is there something we can do as track coaches to stay relevant, do you think? Because, I mean, you stare at everything going, come on, track series, let's go. Let's make some money. But we know that's going to be 5-10 years down the road if that thing keeps going.
Well, I mean, I am the person who's saying, like, the big time has gotten too big. We need to downsize sports and, like, return to a scholastic model. But I think focusing on athletes' holistic development and being able to articulate to bosses like that the project here is developing great humans who are going to go on to do amazing things, who are making the world a better place, who are great ambassadors for this institution. If there's a way to articulate that and show, like to have talking points to show how you are doing these things with your athletes. I've seen too many coaches who are developing their athletes in this way get fired because they're not performing the way a team at this school should be performing at the conference meet or nationally. And that to me is so infuriating because those athletes are getting the best possible college experience they could be getting because this coach has prioritized their well-being and their development as athletes, as students, as humans. And I think if there are ways to capture that and be able to tell a story around that, that's incredibly important right now. I think finding people like me on your campus who are former athletes who are on the academic side and coming up with creative programming, projects, collaborative efforts. I did something with Sun Devil Athletics and our senior woman administrator, Dina Garner-Smith, who's somebody I work on projects with all the time, where I had an undergraduate student take over the social media account of Sun Devil Athletics on Tuesdays, and we called it Title IX Tuesdays. And she'd find stuff in the ASU archives, in the university archives collection to post. If you had, a coach and some athletes who are interested, team teaching, like there's nothing that says that coaches can't team teach. The academic side, oral history, that's another thing that I want to get athletes involved in. The 50th anniversary of Title IX is coming up, and we should be collecting and capturing stories in our local communities, not just the college campus, but like the town and the surrounding areas. And there's hidden Title IX stories everywhere. What's that?
2005.
Nice. Yep. Nice. Yes. So yeah, I think just thinking creatively around how to think of yourself as an educator and the work that you're doing with your athletes is educational, that the results are part of that. Like, again, excellence comes with this other stuff. So I do think that this sort of philosophical approach or model to coaching often also gets results because happy, well-rounded, athletes with good balance often get results. So that would be my kind of collection of recommendations to coaches right now. Because there are athletes on every campus on the academic side who are doing cool work that you could, join.
So I have a question for you, and it's a very related question. Is for your own experience, has there been a coach or an educator that has made an impact on your life?
I mean, I was very fortunate that Michael Whittlesey was the coach at Carolina while I was there. So Coach Witt, he cared about me and He cared about all his athletes and recognized that we were all different. And, you know, our team was very academically focused. I mean, yeah, Shalane Flanagan was winning national championships and Al Schmidt was winning national championships and Aaron Donahue was throwing jab and winning ACC titles and also running the middle distances and, you know, winning ACC titles and placing really well at nationals. And Carol Henry was kicking butt in the steeplechase. I mean, we had outstanding athletes who were also very serious students. And I think Coach Witt did a really good job of giving his athletes space, trusting his athletes that they would get work in, and creating a culture around like working hard, but also playing hard and having fun. And you know, he was coaching, he was also teaching. He at Carolina wanted to teach a class every semester. He has his PhD and was, I think he was teaching kinesiology classes. So he, you know, is a great model of this kind of academic athletic balance. And I mean, I went on a medical red shirt and a medical release. And he, I mean, Coach Witt knew I wanted to get a PhD and like that I might run while in grad school and like was very supportive of that. And UNC, I mean, I got my release in the UNC and also the ACC helped ASU and the Pac-10 get a fifth year and a sixth year, like, again, because they cared about me. And we displaced UNC at the NCAA Indoor Championships by 1 point. In 2006, and I scored 1 point. And 5,000, I placed eighth. And so we, I mean, fortunately, Carolina still trophied. We placed third and they placed fourth. But like, they joked with me about that. Like Dennis Craddock, the director at the time, and Coach Witt were like joking with me about that. And I mean, I understand that this is not necessarily representative of the experiences most athletes have when they're a graduate transfer, but yeah, Coach Witt. And then Louie at ASU, like, oh my gosh, like he absolutely was somebody who cared about the holistic development and the unique qualities of each of his athletes and brought such joy and encouragement and creativity to practice. I mean, it was the best. Like, I mean, it was hard work, but it was fun. And the synergy that's created when people are committed to really challenging projects, but bring like a joyful approach to it. I mean, it's incredible how, you know, Jackie Johnson was winning every single multi NCAA championship she could. And you watch that and our pole vaulter wins and, you know, Amy's kicking butt in the 5K. You just like ride that energy in everybody. Like it is incredible to be part of an excellent program like that. And to have someone who's so understated and yet so exceptional at what he does, make all of his athletes feel good, whether it's, you know, the person winning a national title or it's somebody who's trying to break like 220 in the 800 meters and seeing them equally as humans and like getting excited about everything. That is what I really appreciated about Louie and learned so much, you know, from watching the way he coached and applying that to the way I engage with students now in the classroom too. Yeah.
That's a great answer.
There's a lot there. It was a real, that was brilliant. You kidding me? You went through some good guys and Coach Witt is an incredible guy. Louie's a good guy. Louie is a really good guy as well. No questions about it. Last little question that way. I think the one last thing we have, we'll kind of close on this kind of this topic a little bit. We don't see a lot of females in the coaching world, especially in the track world. We've talked about this before. We go to the convention and and luckily enough, Rhonda Riley, who is somebody who I know, you know, was a GA, I believe, with you for a couple of years, if I'm not mistaken, as Arizona State, has done an unbelievable, unworldly job. I don't know if there's a good word to actually use for what she's done with the women's coaching and the summit that she's done. But is there, and by the summit, by the way, if anybody hasn't listened, the USTFCCCA Coach Association a few years ago started a women's coaching summit. Rhonda was the one, the queen bee behind it. And she has taken it to something that is
unbelievable. Her mentorship program now on Twitter, there's the three different, she's had three different coaches come in and talk so far. She's got one more tomorrow, Sarah Vergote, so it's incredible. Is there some way that we can keep female coaches in coaching?
Yeah, Rhonda rocks. So yes, I share all of that love for Rhonda. Yeah, I was in grad school while Rhonda was our grad assistant. So I think we were technically the same age, but you know, working together in that professional capacity. And anytime I'm back in the triangle, I always make a point to see Rhonda because she's so fabulous. And I love what she's been building at Duke. You know, it's interesting because I always take a historical perspective when I think about questions like this. And if you think about coaching in women's intercollegiate athletics before Title IX passed, and by the end of the 70s, and really once the NCAA started offering women's championships and athletic departments moved women's intercollegiate athletics from women's PE to the formal athletic department, and Title IX compliance kicks in, we see a dramatic drop in the percentage of women coaching women. So before all of these changes, more than 90% of women's teams were coached by women. And now it's just over 40, and it's stagnated. It dropped by the early 80s and it stayed there ever since. And Dr. Nicole Lavoie at the University of Minnesota, she directs the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport, has done a ton of work on this. It's her term describing this as stagnation, but it's different with track and field. that's not the story with track and field because women were not competing in track and field before the 1980s. I mean, think about how recently women's events have been added to the Olympic program in track and field. And it's distances, it's jumps, it's throws, it's across the board. Atlanta 96, you know, not all that long ago is when the women's 5,000 triple jump and hammer throw. I'm like, crap, there was one more hammer throw. So a run, a jump, and a throw were all added to the Olympic program. Women's steeplechase was as recent as 2008. And again, colleges were not competing in women's track and field really until the 1980s. So that means there weren't women coaching track and field because there weren't women's college programs to be coached. And the combined gender sports are different in that it's not the case at every university, but you often have combined coaching so that you have a director, you have one coach who works with all throws, men and women, and you have one coach who works with all jumps, men and women. It's often the jumps and the sprints you might see more separation by gender. And then in the distances, again, depending on the school, you have one coach who works with both men and women. And culturally, the idea of women coaching men is just so rare that the exceptions often prove the rules. We've seen a kind of gradual uptick. There are more women's directors of both men's and women's track now, but again, it's just like a handful. So a handful is more than none, so that's good. But what happens is that you often see women in supportive roles to men. So you might have a men's distance coach with a woman GA, or a volunteer even. She might not even be part of the formal track program at all. And that's hard to create retention when women are often in these subordinate supportive roles, doing the work without the title. I think there's a lot of doing the work without the title that happens and it becomes gendered in that way. When I say that the big time is too big, I often feel very badly for coaches too. There's a lot of work for work's sake that I've seen in college sports that's unnecessary labor. It's almost kind of like glamorizing or putting on a pedestal the idea that you should be working. And I don't know if that necessarily translates to success. So mindfulness around like not working all the time is a way to get more women to stay in the sport too. It's not to say that men aren't also committing more to domestic responsibilities, but we just do know based on research that women continue to do more with childcare and domestic work. And if, you know, this moment when you're deciding whether or not to stay in sport is often the same time that people decide to start to have families, you know, mid-20s to mid-30s. And so, you know, if you look at Muffet McGraw, the very successful longtime women's basketball coach at Notre Dame, she built into her approach to coaching and developing her assistant coaches, like time away, like you do not have to be here all the time. You should be taking time off from work. I don't want you to get burnt out. And I want you to have a healthy relationship with coaching because we all benefit from that. And I think learning from women like Muffet McGraw is a really good way to develop best practices because it's not just women who are going to benefit from changes in the approach to coaching. Everybody benefits if there's a mindfulness and kind of list of best practices so that the well-being of coaches is also part of the conversation. We talk so much about the well-being of athletes, but we should also be talking about the well-being of coaches too.
No, that's incredible. I think we could actually sit down in a whole other podcast and talk about the well-being of coaches. We've got an incredible coach here. There's no question about that. We've got an incredible coach here, Coach Randy Norton. If you watch him on Instagram, look up Randy Norton just for the fun of it. The one thing he prioritizes, like the Notre Dame basketball coach, is family first and making sure his assistants are all about family first. And every time there's a picture of him with his assistants, the families are with them. So he's always doing something along those lines. Victoria, this has been incredible. We could probably keep going for more time than we could probably do 3 or 4 parts to this conversation that way. Is there any place that you'd like to send the people listening to us to learn more about you and learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah. Well, to all of you and then anyone listening, please, if you need anything or have any questions or anything at all, I'm victoria.jackson@asu.edu. So that's pretty easy to remember. And yeah, please do, because I think about this stuff probably more than what's healthy. Like when I'm out on my runs in the morning, I'm like, what could we be doing better? So yeah, please hit me up.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate it. It's been an incredible conversation. We very much thank you for that. We look forward to doing this again next week and doing a better job. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And this is going to be a lot of fun. So best of luck. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for pulling up a chair to the Off Track podcast in the brand new Meeting of the Unknowing Minds studio. We're looking forward to that. We're looking forward to that for the next few weeks here. But hopefully you took a lot out of the conversation with Victoria as much as we did. It really challenged us. It really made us think about the way that we look at athletics, and it made us rethink, I think, the way that we look at track and field and our role in universities as a coach. No questions. I did for sure. But we want to thank you again for taking the time out of your day to listen to us. Hopefully we provided some value. And if we did provide some value, please go ahead and rate us on iTunes, share us on Spotify, or whatever the case might be. Word of mouth, without question, is the most important form of advertisement, and it will do us a ton. So please go ahead, share us, like us, retweet us, tell your friends about what we've been doing. It's something that we're trying to do to help expand the knowledge of our fellow track and field coaches, no matter the level, whether it be D1, D2, D3, or even high school. We truly appreciate you guys listening. And of course, as we're sitting in the middle of the holiday season, hopefully your Christmas was incredible. Sitting up here in Wisconsin, I got a lot of snow everywhere, so at least I got snow, being the Midwest guy I am. But hopefully your New Year's is great. You guys are safe, and it's been some incredible time with the family. So we will definitely see you. We're going to take a week off, but we'll definitely go ahead and see you guys right away in January. So looking forward to doing better next time. Stay safe. Drink the eggnog. Enjoy, guys. Thank you.